Hello, and welcome to the Comics in the Golden Age podcast. This is Mike Lane, and I want to welcome back to the show a very special guest. We've seen him before. It is the Podcrasher himself, Mr. Tim Price. Welcome, Tim.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for having me on the show again. How are you doing?
I am doing great. How about you? How are you holding up during this whole, year we've been going through?
It's been a year. There's no doubt about that. Although that would make it feels like almost like 10 years, and that means that when we last recorded, that would have been 6.5 years ago. Okay, yeah, that the math's about right on that. No, I'm doing fine. I'm having lots of fun with podcasting. I've actually got, as you probably know, and most people, maybe other listeners know, I started headlining my own podcast, the Outcasters, which features Batman and the Outsiders from the 1980s. So that's been a lot of fun. And I've been doing the editing myself, and I'm a crazy person for doing editing myself, but I could have just let other people continue to do the editing. What was I thinking?
You've made a huge mistake. And I say that having made that mistake myself. Yeah, I apologize. I shouldn't call you Podcrasher anymore. That's not even an apt term. You're a podcaster now.
No, it's completely appropriate because crash has, you know, a couple of meanings. One is barging in uninvited. The other is to make something fall apart disastrously. So that's me. I think that works perfectly for me.
Yeah, that's fair. We'll go with that. Mm-hmm. So last time Tim was here, we already went through, you know, I asked people who come on what their own comics origin story are. And I made poor Tim already go through that before. So this time we could just jump ahead and get straight.
I think you made your poor listeners go through that before.
No. It was fascinating. Tonight we are going to talk about. Well, this is why I have Tim on here, to talk about superheroines of the 40s and 50s. That is his specialty. That is what he's into. That is his kink, so to speak. We are here to talk about Undercover Girl, also known as Star Flag.
I don't know if I would say kink. I don't know if I would say that. But just because the last time I was on, we talked about Miss Victory, who was a blonde female superhero who had fantastic artists, and she kicked butt and, you know, and did not have a male character come in to rescue her ever. I don't see the similarity between these two characters.
No. So let's talk about Undercover Girl, Star Flag, the blonde, tough fighting woman that we're going to cover today. She was a secret agent for the American government, although precisely which agency she worked for sort of fluctuated based on individual stories, but, you know, not typical, atypical of the era. She was an expert in martial arts, and she really was. She was quite the fighter, and she also knew how to use a gun. She was created by Gardner Fox and Ogden Whitney, and she first appeared in Manhunt No. 1, which was cover dated October 1947. She appeared in 12 issues of that title, as well as 2 issues of the series Trail Cult, and 3 issues of her own self-titled series. Now, that was 3 issues. They were numbered 5, 6, and 7, because numbering was screwy back then, as we've covered many times before. And, of course, Gardner Fox, the writer who co-created her. I'm sure anyone listening to this has heard of Gardner Fox, the, you know, man co-created Flash, Hawkman, Sandman, Dr. Fate, Starman, Justice Society of America, Justice League. I could go on for a long time on the list of people because it's friggin' Gardner Fox. I should mention, if you want to know more about Gardner Fox, there is a wonderful biography out there by Jennifer Day Ross that you should look for. She was on the show before, and you probably, hopefully, remember that. If you haven't listened to it, you should, because it was a wonderful episode, and she is delightful. So, again, for more on Gardner Fox, check out her biography. Now, the artist was Ogden Whitney, although he was also a bit of a writer himself, but he was very prolific in the Golden and Silver Age as an artist, and he worked for just about every company at some point, DC, Marvel. He worked on ACG titles like Adventures Into the Unknown, Forbidden Worlds. He worked on Thunder Agents in the 60s. He actually passed away in the early 70s, unfortunately, but in 2007, he was inducted into the Eisner Hall of Fame. So we're going to start off with stories from issue 6 of her own self-titled series, Undercover Girl. And that is dated, that came out in 1953. So I'm going to turn it over to my partner here, Tim, and let him talk about the first one.
Sure. So we have the story that's called The Kidnapping of Major Amersley. Now, the synopsis goes like so. Starflag is in a luxurious hotel lobby somewhere in South America, and she's heading upstairs to interview Major Amersley, not knowing four foreign agents are following her up to the major's room to abduct him for questioning of their own. But the thugs aren't prepared when Amersley punches one, and Star decks another with her handbag weighted with a revolver and flips another. But the rout is ended when the last thug conks Amersley with a vase and knocks out Star. When she wakes up, Star follows the agent's car on a motorcycle to an abandoned mining shack. To flush out the brutes, she sets fire to the underbrush, and when they flee, Star darts inside to grab the major and escape on her cycle. But they're followed in turn to the city by the thugs. Star leads Amersley to the top of a building and fights to hold off the goons, making a lot of noise to attract the attention of the people in the neighboring office of Star's newspaper, where reporters are taking photos and a newsreel of the spies. As the outed agents flee, Major Amersley muses that they've outlived their usefulness to even their own country, and it's time to finish their interview and send the coded message stateside. So what'd you think of that story?
I loved it, and I love Star. She is a badass. I dig that she rides a motorcycle. Mm-hmm. I like that she has no hesitancy to leap into danger at any time. There is a troubling tendency, as we'll see again in my story, to let the bad guys go away at the end rather than capture them. But I guess, you know, like they said, these guys are disowned, so they're not safe. But I like that she was rescuing the man in the story. And, you know, little touches, like you said, having clocking the guy with a purse that was weighted down by the gun, that was pretty nice. So I love Star. What do you think of it?
Oh, I really adore it. It's like the image of her on the cover of this particular issue shows her on a motorcycle. Now, she's not wearing the same outfit that's in this story. I don't think it's in any of the stories actually in this issue. But it's a, you know, pretty fetching outfit. A nice brightly colored top, and she's got like a green skirt hanging off, and she's driving the motorcycle, and she looks angry as she's driving away from bullets that are going past her, looking very determined. And it's like, that's a great action shot. And it's like, when it says the big logo, Undercover Girl, and you're just thinking James Bond all the way. And this has to predate any of the James Bond movies.
Now the books, so, I don't know if the books books might be out by now.
Yeah, that's what I would think. But it also tells you, all you need to know is that she's going to dress fashionably. She, you know, is gorgeous, and she's not being rescued. She's not being shown in distress. She's, you know, taking charge. Now, the distress thing also is something that kind of we get into in some of the stories, but That's not a situation for this particular story. I mean, here she's got her purse, and it's like, yeah, she just clocks the guy with her purse. Now, that's probably effective in on itself, considering what most women carry in their purses. But the fact that she has a gun in there as well, and they say that in the dialogue that she's got a revolver in it, and whack, it's like, yeah, the guy goes down. Now, the interesting thing on that page is that I said that she flips another guy to take him out. But in the lower corner on that page, I really am not sure what they're depicting there. I mean, she's kind of like underneath, and the two thugs are almost look like they're jumping over her, but that can't be right. I don't know it really confused me a bit.
I'm not sure either. Overall, though, what did you think of Ogden Whitney's art?
Oh, I love it. I love this artwork. I mean, it's got some action to it. I'm trying to think of what other influences I've seen that might come from this. It's more fluid than, say, Ditko. Mm-hmm. It's got some of the energy that you might think from that I might pick from Jack Kirby, but I just I love the faces he gives her. And he gives the character, all the men, they're very different faces. I really like that.
Yeah, the faces in particular, I saw a little bit of a Milton Caniff kind of influence in the way he drew, particularly the male faces, not necessarily the bodies, but although for an artist of that era, they probably all were influenced to some degree by him. But I definitely got that vibe. I liked that he drew her beautiful, but not necessarily like flowery beautiful. Like she does look tough in a lot of these images. Her facial expression, like you said, she looks angry. She's not like a delicate flower in the way he draws her. Like, it's believable she's going to leap over stuff and she's going to clock guys. And he definitely gives her a strength in how he draws her. And I like some of the shot, like with the guys rolling over the barrels and stuff. It's a very dynamic shot there. So he was a good artist, particularly in this era. So I really liked his work.
Yeah, when you talk about her face and her eyes, it's like I'm probably more into it than I should, but he gives intelligence from her eyes.
Oh, yeah.
It's not glamour eyes. There's smarts there. And her facial expressions either could be a determined sort of sneer, not always fierce. Sometimes it's just like, yeah, just a person who's like thinking about things. And then when she smiles, it's like there's a little bit of mischievous to that, too. It's like, you know, she which the canniness, the cleverness that's behind there. So I really dig that. And yeah, like in Shaw, she's beautiful, but she's not overtly sexy. She was wearing like a green dress this entire issue with like a little almost bow tie looking thing on the top. But it's like we see some of her legs, but it's not like she's showing a whole lot of skin at all. She's just almost modestly covered in this dress.
Yeah.
But she's, you know, she'll just pull up above her knees a little bit. It's because she has to kick and push people with her legs and just be practical riding on a motorcycle like that. But yeah, she's just great fun. And yeah, of course, she has to throw out a big bad pun when she's fighting the thugs on the roof. Think, I think I'll give you both barrels. And she rolls a barrel at them. It's like, oh, yes, thank you for that.
One thing I thought interesting about this is the timing of the story, because and I don't really have any conclusion from it, but I was just thinking about the fact that her character first appeared in 47. This is about 53 that this came out. She doesn't have too much longer of a life shelf, really. I mean, really at all, after just another issue too, I think. But it's interesting if you compare, like, at this time, Wonder Woman, you know, or sometime in the year or two vicinity of this, is moving away from the more sort of women's lib kind of approach that the creators had her in. Dekaniger taking over, and his moving more into kind of a goofier romance type of angle, where, you know, Wonder Woman is going to lose a lot of that sort of independent streak, and it's going to be more about her relationship with Steve Trevor, or more romantic type bent to things, and more fighting goofy and alien stuff like that. But it's just an interesting contrast that where she's going to move away like that, Star is very much in that older mode where she is the tougher, you know, stronger, independent character who goes into battle, fights on her own, stuff like that. So it's just kind of an interesting timing there where we're still in that period where, you know, and really for a while there's some, but really, you know, you kind of have more female characters prominently like this in the 40s and early 50s, and then they kind of go away for a while. There's not that many of them for a number of years. And I don't know how much that's a reflection of kind of the Leave It to Beaver women in the household position and that's kind of prominent in the culture of the area, kind of moving away from like Rosie the Riveter of the 40s to, you know, June Cleaver of the 50s or what. But, you know, she's still, you know, Star is very much in that earlier period of the kind of tougher, you know, broad of the 40s who's out there, you know, fighting with her fists. And definitely something that I think is lost a lot in comics for a number of years, kind of shortly after she disappears.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd agree. Because like we see from the stories that I read here, I read all issues, all three of 5, 6, and 7. It's like there's no love interest, really. There's really no recurring male characters. It's it's like one-offs or maybe one who might appear in two different stories, but not a whole lot there. So her stories are definitely not about romance, and there's never her being captured and then being rescued by somebody else. We do have, like, in this story, which is an interesting turnaround, is that the major is captured, gets tied up, and she has to rescue him.
Yeah.
So that's a great reversal of that.
Yeah, definitely not what you would typically see, you know, even with sort of more stronger female characters in that era, having her without him having some moment. And he did, you know, he wasn't incapable at all. He, you know, got
messages
too. But there was never some moment where they had to pull back a little and have him be like the hero and stuff to kind of balance things out again. They didn't feel the need to do that balance that sometimes people did in the stories to kind of almost feel this need to kind of correct it. Instead, they let her be the very clear hero doing the rescue without weakening him or making him seem emasculated or anything. He was still, you know, a tough guy, but she was just the John McClane who went in there and, you know, saved the day, clearly.
Yes, indeed. And also with that over the topness, it's like, so she starts a forest fire in a South American jungle to rescue him. I hope that at the end of the story, there's an offhand, there's an addendum where, and she called the fire department and the police to go take out the forest fire that she started.
Yeah. Instead, versus 10,000 poor people, families losing their homes and having to flee because of this massive inferno. Yeah.
But we defended democracy.
Oh, it would be the sadly perfect Cold War ending if that poor fire did go on to just ravage. Yeah, we'll see if she called the fire department and took care of that. I did think that, though. I was like, damn, she's not messing around there.
No, definitely not. But yeah, and this is interesting with her, with it. She obviously has like a variety of covers. It seems like perhaps Girl Reporter is her typical cover. And it's like, man, yeah, she's what Lois Lane could have been.
Oh, yeah.
If they had not put her with Superman.
Yeah. Did you ever, I'm asking, of course you probably like me grew up watching Adventures of Superman.
Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm. I always had the impression that the first actress, Phyllis Coates, was much more, and I love, no disrespect to Noel Neal, I met her twice, I loved her dearly, but Phyllis Coates was the tougher one. She was like the one I found more believable as like a hard-nosed reporter. She stood up for herself. She just came off, her whole demeanor, I could see that being like a live-action version of Undercover Girl, the way she carried herself in that first season, you know, had still the very much, 1940s hairstyle, the same kind of suits that Undercover Girl wore, but the much tougher kind of approach versus that later Lois Lane interpretation, which was much more comedic and kind of, I don't know, like Noel Neal was a lot of things, but she never came off as particularly like tough or hard-nosed in her episodes versus Phyllis, who did often.
Yes. Well, so I'm already, you know, starting to write my fan fiction where Clark Kent eventually meets Undercover Girl when she's on assignment somewhere. And inadvertently helps her, but at the end it's like, or at least tries to help her, but it's like she doesn't need him, and he's always going like, well, I guess I can put my glasses back on.
I would be curious if someone took like a Roy Thomas approach and tried to reconcile her employment history, because I kind of alluded to this. I know there is at least an instance or two where she is working for the CIA. But there's quite a few stories where she seems to much more be a military intelligence type character involved with one of the branches of the military. So maybe she's just one of those super talented people that they're loaning out to different groups, you know, because she's just that good.
Well, I already did kind of start putting together that with her last name of Flag, she's probably affiliated with Task Force X somewhere along the way. And she's the either sister or cousin of the original Rick Flag, but just spells her name with an extra G. And just the madness goes from there.
Well, there is nothing more Roy Thomas than taking two comic characters with the same last name and retroactively creating a familiar relationship.
That's right.
He would be very proud of you right now for doing that. Thank you.
Thank you.
That is Pete Roy Thomas right there, actually. I remember the Graysons in All-Star Squadron when he had to give them the familial background together.
Oh, but, right.
So that's totally right up his alley. Any final thoughts on this one before we move on to the next one?
I don't think so. I think we covered it all. How about you?
Not really. I think we're good to go. So I am going to cover sorry, let me pause. What was the title of that? I wrote down everything except the title. I'm going to edit this out.
That's fine. Let's see. The Doom of Siva Day.
So glad you said Siva, because that's what I've been saying. I was hoping I was right. Okay, let me try this again. Okay, so I'm going to cover the next story in issue 6, which is titled The Doom of Siva Day. Now, this one is interesting because it opens mid-adventure with Star already being held by this giant living stone statue. Now, the statue appears to be under the control of a mysterious woman and is about to eat Star when she's able to leap free just in time. She escapes and reaches her car before the giant can get after her. She is able to head back to the intelligence headquarters in Rangalore, which I should note that this story seems to be set in India. I don't think, I could be wrong, I'm pretty sure there's not a real place named Rangalore, so I'm thinking it's like a take on Bangalore, which is a city in India because I went there once. So I think that's what they're getting at. But in any event, when she gets back to their intelligence headquarters, we get some exposition here to explain what's been going on. It appears they've been trying to track down rumors of a fabulous invention by a woman named Siva Day that's capable of animating stone. And obviously, Star's adventure proved that rumor to be true. At the same time, in a remote corner of the hill country, Siva Day has gathered the local tribesmen to show them how she is able to animate stone using her device. They believe her to be a goddess and submit to her rule. She orders them into Rangalore to gather the metals and chemicals she needs to make more devices. After they depart, Star arrives on horseback, having tracked down Siva Day. The two are wrestling when a giant stone hand appears and grabs Star. Siva slaps the captive Star and orders that she be chained to a rock until her return. Siva goes to animate more statues that she plans to use to take over Rangalore. She will take her next step then, which will be to make all the statues in India come alive. Then she'll be unstoppable. Meanwhile, Star has realized that it is so hot outside that if she turns over and lets the heat hit her handcuffs, it may cause them to expand enough for her to get free. It ends up that the cuffs heat so much as to almost burn her flesh before she is able to wiggle free. On horseback, she's able to beat Siva Day to Rangalore. There, she gets gathered some dynamite and wires a pass that Day must travel through with her stone statues. And once she's there, she warns Day to surrender or be destroyed by the dynamite. Siva Day agrees and slowly turns away, leaving her statued army behind. And once she's gone, Star blows up the valley, destroying all the statues. A few days later, at a hotel in Calcutta, Star approaches the front desk. She is asked if anything is wrong with her room and responds that everything is fine except for the statue in her hand. She explains that there's just something about statues that give her cold feet.
Womp womp.
Star Trek laugh, giggle, ending.
Freeze frame.
So what did you think of that one?
Oh, it's a fun little story. It's really interesting with it starting in with the action. And it's kind of like, you just from just look at the panels alone, you kind of go, how did she get here? How did she get in the middle of this mess? It's kind of got that serial movie feel to it. Jumping in off from a cliffhanger from a previous episode, even though we haven't had a lead up to it, it's fine. You get the point. They give enough exposition for you to jump in. That's a fun little story.
Yeah, having that, my favorite part was the fact that they opened it with her already being held by this giant statue. And it kind of, like you said, along the serial, it had a very kind of Indiana Jones vibe-ish to it because it was set in this ancient temple. The statue that was holding her was clearly this kind of ancient statue of some sort of god. It also kind of reminded me of some of the Carl Barks duck stories set in kind of a similar environment. Mm-hmm. So I very much enjoyed that.
Nice.
The only thing I would possibly take away from this story is there was a little the way it's like I enjoyed the opening more than like the previous story, but the latter half of the story I didn't enjoy as much as the previous one because it wasn't, it kind of, what am I trying to say? It was kind of like she sent these guys to Rangalore to steal the supplies she needed, but then we never really touched on that again. I guess the fact that she later had more statues, they must have gotten stuff for her, but it wasn't really addressed in the story. And then she gets to the valley where Star had set up the dynamite and then just kind of walks off at the end. And I don't really get the sense that Star and them are going after her. And the way she kind of just turned around and left, like, I really was digging her villain, because there was very much kind of this dragon lady vibe to her. And she had this kind of,
yeah,
trying to think of how to describe the outfit, kind of similar to like I Dream of Jeannie, but mostly kind of greenish. And
yeah, that's really fair.
Yeah, I liked her a lot. But then I was kind of disappointed that she just like, oh, well, there's dynamite. I guess I better just go home. And she literally just kind of walks away at the end, which just found to be a bit of a lackluster resolution to it. You know,
I'd agree. That's where it's easy to focus on the jumping in point, the starting point, because it's really just a gripping there. But yeah, the rest of the story doesn't hold up as well. It's like, okay, so she's got the statues and we see the cliches of obviously they could have killed Star at any time and then all be done, but they don't do it, even though they have her at their mercy at every point. They still don't kill her. Why? Because story. It's like they really didn't know what – they had this great idea about, well, make a things come to life.
Yeah.
But they weren't quite sure how to really believably resolve it.
Exactly. Yeah.
I did like how, you know, Star got herself out of being handcuffed and chained up. And I even liked the touch of them saying that it got really hot and she almost burned herself in the process.
That was a nice touch, yeah.
Yeah, that's a very nice touch. But also, they also don't address the fact that she still has the device that brings things to life. the bad guy, Siva Day, she has the device that brings things to life still with her. They didn't get that away from her on panel. So what's to stop her from doing it again? So maybe I'll just write it in that, okay, so she's walking away and she's trying really hard to look dejected and defeated. Oh no, you've destroyed my statues. Well, I guess I can't come back again another day and wreak havoc upon civilization.
She was dramatically overacting when she had that kind of pouty face and walked away at the final scene.
Exactly. Star also looks really great in this particular. She's got, as I like the Indiana Jones riff that you called out. That's really great because she's got like a red top and the brown khaki jeans on. That really does look good for the outdoorsiness of the situation. And it's one of those, I guess, what is it, like a peasant blouse sort of thing? Because she wears it off her shoulders. So she looks really gorgeous in that. But boy, if you're interested in any damsel in distress sort of storylines, you get some here. First, she gets into a wrestling fight with Siva Day, and then she's grabbed by the statue hand, not once, but twice, and chained up afterwards and having to lie face down to get herself out. It's like, okay.
Well, I mean, this is still a comic story about a female character, so a little bit of bondage is kind of now and then has to show up.
That's like, if they don't tie her up, then they've got to kill her. So, you know, it's like, okay, at least they didn't do that, because that's a different kind of problem. But it's still, it's like, yeah, this is, as a trope, we all recognize it as the trope of the tie. That's what you do. You tie up James Bond. It's like, I expect you to die. You leave the room. And somehow he got out while you were outside of the room. Who would have believed it?
You know, one thing you mentioned earlier, too, the statue, the whole concept of the statue making them come alive, that there's this device that animates them. It's ridiculous, of course, but one thing I liked about it a lot is it very much reminded me of Silver Age DC. Like, I could see that in a Doom Patrol story. I could see that in, like, a Strange Adventures. It's just very much in keeping of that classic Silver Age DC science fiction where, you know, kind of Julia Schwartz love that you come up with this ridiculous science fiction premise, but it's still fun and it's entertaining and it leads to great visuals, you know, this giant ancient statue coming to life thing. It's crazy, but it works so well in the story, and it's just a lot of fun. As ridiculous as it is, it's just fun.
Oh, absolutely. Well, if you think about it too hard, it's not fun anymore. So I don't want to think about it too hard. But, you know, when the statue on the first page is like opens his mouth to chew her in his teeth, are we supposed to believe that the sculptor actually made teeth inside the statue's closed-lipped mouth in order? Well, or maybe, oh, no, I guess he probably had him sculpted with his mouth open, and now that he's come to life, he's been closing his mouth. Okay, that's fine. That's fine.
So now I'm trying to decide if it has like a whole digestive system once it came to life.
That would be another sort of problem there. Yeah. But yeah, and it's also, it's definitely a case where we're going to cross genres just because. It's like Undercover Girl, Star Flag, Secret Agent Spy. Why is she fighting gigantic statue monsters being brought to life? Why is this a villain who can bring statues to life? It's like, just because. Because it's a fun story. It's like we're not really beholden to the genre of noir or spy thriller, even though that obviously is what the character was grown from, and I love her for that.
And when you do like, you just have to throw
giant statues.
When you do your fan fiction where she meets Superman, you can do the follow up where they finally go back and deal with Siva Day still having these devices. Right. And, you know, having him will help obviously because he's
Not that she needs it,
but, you know.
I've also decided that now I've changed my mind about her relationship with Task Force X, is that now the name Flag is a title and not someone's actual real last name. So that's why it can be spelled differently for Rick Flag versus Star Flag. And they're just like James Bond himself, like an inherited title is what they've been pushing now for his continuity. It's like, that's all it is. The head agents of Task Force X, name Flag, Digistar.
See, now I'm going to imagine she had this whole history where she was assigned to the task force for a while and was, you know, off on her own having adventures with him as well.
Well, and she would fit in pretty nicely between World War II Suicide Squad and the 60s Suicide Squad. So that would work.
Yeah. See, you should be writing comics, Tim.
I could be writing bad comics. I could probably do that.
You know, one thing that I also noticed just as interesting is that Ogden Whitney signed most of these stories. His signature is actually in there, which is not unheard of at the time. You know, I see Charles Byrow's signature and the crime books he worked on, and, you know, EC Comics focused on some of their artists, but it definitely had not become a common thing at this point yet, like it did with Marvel and after Marvel in the 60s. So it is kind of nice to see Ogden signing his work and, you know, especially with his real name and taking pride in it and having him get some credit for it. So that was a nice thing to see in his stories too.
I agree. I've got a real kick out of seeing his signature on there. It's like, I guess there's his name snuck in on the last page of this story in the top. Just had a nice open spot there. Just Ogden Whitney. That's just great. I do like that.
That's interesting too, because he kind of sneaks it into different spots in each story. It's not like it's not always on the first page or in the last panel. It kind of pops up here and there in different places throughout the story. It's not hidden. I mean, it's not like it's
you can't
find it, but it just does bounce around a lot, which is just kind of a nice touch.
Mm-hmm.
Well, any final thoughts about this one?
It's a shame that this character is not more known and not more used. She's just obviously a very strong female character. I think she would a new interpretation of her today would be pretty great. I think she would hold up pretty well. Even having just some fun with her older stories would work out in today's readership. She's just a fun character. She's just there's no doubt about it. She has a great pedigree of creators who, you know, gave her introduction. She's just great fun.
Yeah, and I noticed when I was looking at it that Ogden, you know, a lot of these times, particularly in this period, the artist would help create the character and draw them for a while, but I'll inevitably move on to different projects. But Ogden, at least all the ones I saw, he drew just about every story. He drew, I don't know if he did every one in Manhunt, but he did all the ones I saw in her regular series. And I know he did the ones in Trail Cult as well. So I wonder if he had, I wonder if it was more a situation where he just enjoyed and had a good relationship with Gardner Fox, or if he was just that prolific with this company that he drew that much, or maybe he even, maybe he had some affection for the character. I don't know. Possible. It'd be nice to think he did, you know, because it was 47 he first did it. It's 53 here, and you know, he's still drawing the character after all those years. So that's nice to see as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I was a little not sure if he did the cover of this issue or not, because her face is just a little different from how it's handled on the inside. But that might be just more because he wasn't given the real estate to do more zooms on her faces inside the pages. But I'm not positive if this is him. Actually, I'm looking. I see the signature at the bottom.
And it is not is him.
Purcell?
Powell. It is
Powell.
Powell. So you were right. Yeah. I could not remember at all one way or the other. But on Grand Comics database attributes it to Bob Powell. And it looks like of the three issues that were his self-titled, it looks like the first one, they have a question mark, which means they're not sure, but they think the first cover was Dick Ayers. The second cover, Bob Powell, which they seem certain of, and I guess because the signature's there. It looks like Bob Powell did the third one. And you can definitely tell that the person who did the first cover is very different than Bob Powell in style, because her whole look is very different. And her look in the first cover is much more – it's not nearly as tough of a character. It's much more of sort of a softer – kind of more beautiful model type look to the character. And then the other two issues both have a much tougher approach to the character. And you're right, it doesn't look like Ogden necessarily, but it at least looks more consistent in that she's kind of a bad, I mean, God, in the final one, she's holding on to the side of a car as it crashes into the corner of a building, wrecking, shattering the front of the car. But she's not holding on like she's scared or something. She's holding on like, reaching into the car like this was what she wanted to happen. Like she was there messing with these guys, wanted them to crash the car, and she's just waiting for them to do and be disabled and but so she's, even though it's a dangerous situation, she does not look particularly frightened.
No, that's definitely the look they were going for. That's one thing that's consistent between the three covers, is that she does look like she's in charge and determined. Right.
One nice touch on the third one I like is that very in the background you see the Eiffel Tower there. And it's just kind of nice to know. I can't remember, and I have no idea if that had anything to do with any story in the issue. But, you know, when you're trying to do a secret agent cover, you know, thinking to set it in obviously you know, foreign locales that people know is always a good touch. So seeing the Eiffel Tower there kind of makes the scene.
Yeah, I do like that. As like, and that is actually a contrast between even like the first cover, like you said, from issue 5. It's a pretty nondescript location where there's a man being chained up in the background. It's like it could be in a warehouse or some other abandoned building. It's like it's not it doesn't really evoke world travel, or it doesn't necessarily even evokes, you know, the James Bond feel. It evokes a hero feel, a rescuing or a noir feel, but not the spy feel. But yeah, issues 6 and 7, those covers both, you know, say like, yes, this is, she's traveling the world. She goes to, you don't know where she's going to turn up, fighting a good fight for America.
Yeah. The second one, the nice touch is having some palm trees in the background, and next to the style of the building there, it definitely gives off a vibe of like Latin America or South America when you're looking at it as well. So yeah, very similar. Like you said, that cover reinforces that, you know, this is James Bondish going off around the world, being that, you know, exotic locales type of sense to it. So yeah, those two covers are definitely the superior one. You're right, the first one, she is strong, she's got a gun on a guy, she's clearly rescuing that dude who's chained up in the background, but you know, it doesn't have the international feel that makes these other two more fun.
Yeah, I wonder if they would try to bring her back just to say, even like as a cameo role, or yeah, as a senior kind of character, just as a historical character for other people, for more modern, mentees or new spies or anybody to come along. It's like they hear about the legendary Star Flag or something like that.
I mean, she is a public domain character now, so there's no reason anyone couldn't user, and it wouldn't surprise me if that, I'm totally blanking on it. I'm sure someone listening is going to know it, but that company that throughout the 90s to now sort of brought back a lot of the Golden Age public domain characters, wouldn't surprise me if they, particularly they've done a lot of kind of good girl art type stories of people, wouldn't surprise me if they've used her. It looks like she did get collection that came out in 2015 from, I think it's called Boardman Books. And I think they used a cover from one of the Manhunt issues. It's a really nice cover. Mm. Although in this cover, it's much more of a damsel in distress thing because a guy's holding her down. Mm. And they basically look like they're trying to push her into the electric chair. She's drawn by Ogden Whitney, but the way she's drawn looks much more like a Matt Baker cover. She's got much more of an exotic, sexy kind of Matt Baker-ish look to her. But I am
interesting.
She got a trade.
I haven't seen that cover yet. Interesting. I might have to go look for that then. Yes. Matt Baker, you say?
It's not by Matt Baker. It's definitely by Ogden. But it just has that kind of sense to it.
Nice. Well, that's not a bad style to be modeling after.
Oh, no, not at all.
No, definitely not.
He knew how to draw the ladies, so. Well, Tim, I want to thank you, man, for coming on. This was a lot of fun. I really appreciate it. I always enjoy talking superheroines with you. And, well, superheroines, exotic, beautiful secret agents.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you for having me on. I had a great time. If it hadn't been for your Twitter feeds, I wouldn't have been introduced to this character in the first place. So thank you.
No, it's funny. One of the things I think we ease in this is because you commented a few times about some of the more obscure kind of female heroes from this era. And they are, when you look at them, they do jump out because there is a certain uniqueness, you know, to some of them. Like Pat Patriot is fun. I mean, yeah, she's a patriotic character, but she's a fun character. She's got her little team of international female heroes that she joins up with. Mm-hmm. You know, like you were talking about earlier, the one you came to cover last time. And this one, I mean, they kind of jump around to cover all the genres, but there is just something really entertaining about them. And I'm really glad you've been coming on to talk to me about them.
Yeah, well, it's been a lot of fun. Thank you so much.
All right. Well, I know you talked about it a little earlier, but could you tell everyone again where they can find you either on podcasting or on the internet?
Absolutely. I don't know why anybody would want to find me, but if you do, my Twitter handle is @TimPrice17. I do lots of tweeterings there. And the podcasts that I regularly appear on include the Batgirl Cassandra Cain podcast from the Right On Network with Ashford Wright. You can find that on our website, thehuntresspodcast.com, because it shares a feed with the Huntress Podcast. Interesting how that worked out. And the Twitter handle for that show is @HuntressPodcast. And also with that same feed, you also would find The Outcasters, a Batman and the Outsiders podcast, where Ashford and I switch from being Johnny and Ed to the other roles. And we discuss the Batman and the Outsiders from 1980s. We're getting through the first year right now, and it's been lots of fun. We've gotten a lot of great support for it, and we're so grateful to everybody who's listened to the show.
Excellent. Awesome. Yes, everyone, please check out Tim's shows and check in on him on Twitter. He's a fun follow. So with that, I'm going to wrap things up. And again, thank you very much, Tim, and thank everyone for joining me once again to talk Golden Age comic books. I appreciate it. You know, if nothing else, you know, as horrible as this pandemic and this year has been, it has allowed me to get more back into the podcasting thing after, you know, getting fewer and farther between for a long time with the show. So having the extra time has had some benefit. So again, thank you all for sticking with me during that time instead of disappearing. That's also very much appreciated. And with that, I'm going to wrap things up. Take care.